Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzdraber. On today's show, the future of driverless cars. We've talked about the regulations before, you know, specifically that the National Highway Safety and Traffic Administration put out, but we're going to take a step back and kind of look at this industry as a whole and how it's evolving and when people can expect to see the cars on the roads and how the various levels of government, state, local, and federal, are going to be working together to address things like privacy and cybersecurity. So joining me to discuss this topic is Jamie Boone, Senior Director of Government Affairs for the Consumer Technology Association, and prior to that, she worked on The Hill. Jamie, thanks for joining.
Thanks, Evan. I'm excited to be here and talk about my favorite topic.
So that's what everyone always wants to know, right? Is like, when is this going to happen? Because, you know, people, maybe they're going to the dealership to buy a new car and they're like, I don't know, should I hold off until there's a driverless future? I mean, just kind of give us that 30,000 foot view of the industry and what people can be expecting in the next 5, 10, 20 years.
Absolutely. I know. I can't wait until I get this technology. I've had conversations with people that has been, you know, the next car that you buy will be the last one that you're going to drive yourself. You know, maybe that's a little optimistic on my part because I can't wait for this technology to get here. But, you know, it's coming. This technology is developing really quickly. It's you know, been around for, you know, for a while, actually. You know, this all started back in, you know, 2004, 2007 with DARPA and the DARPA challenge. But industry has just taken off. You're seeing, you know, partnerships between traditional automakers and, you know, startups and tech companies that is really driving the pace of innovation. So, you know, will we have totally self-driving cars? Well, you'll go and buy one in by 2020, 2021. Probably not. You know, I see this rolling out more gradually, either, you know, some of these elements of autonomy being integrated in new vehicles or really in the ride sharing capacity, you know, with the Ubers and the Lyfts of the world, getting their hands on this technology first and being able to execute it around cities and more urban environments where the mapping is easier.
Yeah, we've seen the mayor of Pittsburgh get really excited about the fact that Uber, you know, if you use Uber in Pittsburgh, there's a chance that the car you drive in is actually going to be a driverless car. Now, this whole kind of symbiosis between the traditional automakers and technology companies is kind of interesting because is it at a simple level just that the traditional automakers have certain capabilities like mass manufacturing standards, complying with old regulations about cars, and then but they're not necessarily as cool and innovative as the tech companies? So is it just like a natural alliance, or are these more of competitors?
It's a little bit of both. You know, I see, I think it's a really positive thing. You know, you're right. These traditional automakers know how to manufacture at a large scale. They have the, you know, the bandwidth, they have the facilities to do that. And they know how to deal with regulators. They're used to dealing with DOT and with NHTSA. You know, whereas the tech companies, especially the smaller guys, you know, they're super creative, really smart, have lots of fresh, new, innovative ideas that sometimes don't come up through the traditional automaker sense, but don't know how to manufacture on a large scale or don't know how to deal with regulators. So I think this combination of the two really puts together the best of both worlds. You're seeing, you know, you're starting to see some competition between the two as well, especially for talent. There seems to be, you know, a shortage of really good engineers that are able to really work on this technology that, you know, I'll tell you what, I wish that my degree was in something like this because, you know, the salaries are off the charts.
Yeah, I mean, I just majored in communications and look at me, I just host this stupid podcast. I could be making self-driving cars.
What were we thinking?
Yeah. So, of course, you know, government is obviously trying to grapple with this challenge and it's a fast-paced technology which creates problems for a slow-moving government. But in general, when we look at the federal aspect, which, as you mentioned, NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration, a lovely acronym, and then you've got DOT, the Department of Transportation. What has the federal government's approach been to self-driving cars thus far, and is it good or is it bad?
So far, it's been generally positive. You know, industry has certainly said, you know, early and often that we need flexibility and the ability to innovate. You know, don't regulate innovation out of existence. So NHTSA and DOT in particular have been pretty good to work with. You know, they set out the federal AV policy as a set of voluntary guidelines. So not having, you know, specific technology mandates is a huge plus and a huge positive. So I think they're really moving in the right direction on that front. You know, of course, there are definitely areas of potential improvement. And I think one of the best things that NHTSA did when they put this document out was say that this is a, you know, living, breathing document. They plan to continue to update it based on the needs of the technology and based on feedback they're getting. So that's incredibly helpful. I think where we start to see concern is, there are a lot of different agencies that have some kind of tie to something that could be involved in self-driving vehicles. So from a privacy standpoint, a cybersecurity and national security standpoint, liability issues, there are a lot of different issues at play here and a lot of players. So I think, you know, from my perspective, making sure that folks are coordinated in that approach, and, you know, not just throwing things to see what sticks, you know, to this, you know, industry and regulation is important.
And what are those different roles? So if I'm looking at the federal government, I mean, what do you see as the appropriate regulatory authority for the federal government? And then I'm going to, of course, ask you about the state and localities. Yep. But while we're talking about Washington, or we're doing this podcast here in Washington, the federal government, what should their role be in self-driving cars?
Absolutely. You know, NHTSA, the federal government, is the regulator for vehicle safety. That's the way it is laid out in law. And there is nothing, you know, about automated vehicles or that technology that suggests that it should be, you know, anything but that. This is just a continuation of building up of the technology and the capabilities. So the federal government is, you know, the one that decides, you know, what the safety standards are, what the vehicle design elements can be, what can be where in a vehicle. And that's through the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards. You know, they are a little outdated, especially, you know, when it comes to some of these more innovative ideas of no steering wheel or no brake pedal. But that's really where the authority lies. Where states come into play is more on the operation side. So licensing for the driver, human driver. And I think that was actually a good point that was made in the NHTSA guidance was, when the software, the vehicle is the driver of the vehicle, the federal government is the regulator.
It's right, so not the federal government did decide that if the software is driving the car, the federal government will be licensing that software. And is that to prevent essentially 50 different states from having some of them say yes, some of them say no, and now you've got a patchwork, and this particular software could be considered a driver in one state, but it could not be a driver in another state. So
exactly.
That kind of preemption, in your view, is good.
Exactly. Incredibly important, especially when you think further down the road about the opportunities that a truly driverless vehicle provides to folks that aren't traditionally licensed drivers, and can't or aren't eligible for a driver's license. So, you know, the blind or, you know, impaired, visually impaired, the, you know, seniors that maybe just aren't capable of safely getting around anymore. There's a lot of opportunity for them when the vehicle is the driver. So we want to make sure that states aren't getting in the way of that.
So what should the states be doing? I mean, when we think about vehicle regulation in the past, states have a heavy involvement in registration, in insurance, how they want to do their driving test, whether you have to parallel park or not, depending on where you live, that kind of thing. So is that still going to be the case with driverless cars? I mean, you've already identified a huge difference where the state can license a human, but the federal government's going to license the software. What other challenges for states do you see coming down the pike? And what is the appropriate role of state government in regulating a driverless car that deals with the internet and deals with interstate entities?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's, I think, where some of the bigger questions are going to come in. So, you know, the safety, you know, yearly safety and emissions checks that states traditionally do, or, you know, insurance requirements, a lot of those will still stay with the states, at least for the time being, until there's a really total shift in the model. But there are a lot of things that will have to change, especially when it comes to access to roadways, right? Because, you know, like you said, it's an interstate highway system. You can't, you know, expect people to have you know, rules in Pennsylvania and then cross over into Ohio and have a different set of rules to have to follow. So there really is a need for consistency there on, you know, access to the roadways and some of those aspects. But I don't see that so much as a change as just a coordination and a working together of something that's already been the case.
But what about insurance? I mean, that might get a little complicated because we're, you know, when you deal with insurance, now you're dealing with liability for the driver, whoever else might be involved in an accident. You have to have insurance by law to operate a vehicle. When we're dealing with software, who insures that?
That is a big issue that needs to be figured out, right? And I think a lot of that will depend on the level of operation. You know, if it's a level 3 vehicle where the driver really still has to monitor the driving situation, then, you know, your insurance requirements might be a lot like what they are today. But when you're getting to level 4 and level 5, when the vehicle is truly the driver, it doesn't make sense to, there is no operator in the traditional sense. So the insurance requirements are not going to be the same. And the same thing with liability. You know, if a self-driving vehicle causes an accident, which we haven't seen, but if it does, then, you know, who is liable? Is it the manufacturer? It, you know, certainly shouldn't be the driver because there is no driver.
Are states able to figure this out? I mean, have you seen any state governments really try to tackle this complicated issue? Do they even have the expertise necessary?
They've only really tackled started to tackle the liability question more on the testing side and basically just making sure that manufacturers have enough liability coverage to cover any accidents.
Right, because states want to be kind of a sandbox for innovation. Mm-hmm. So they want those companies to not feel threatened by onerous lawsuits.
Right, absolutely. So, the states are having these conversations. I think it's going to be a while until we get the best solution of what that should look like. I think it's something that's going to evolve. But really, I think, you know, the important thing for states to focus on and what you're seeing a lot of states starting to do is removing the barriers to entry that they already have. Some of those outdated rules and regulations that don't make sense for a driverless vehicle. So,
like what?
So New York State has a requirement that driver must have one hand on the wheel at all times. Obviously, that doesn't work for a driverless car. And conflicting ones, which I've recently heard about, you know, in New Jersey, I might get this backwards, but it's in New Jersey, you have to beep your horn when you're going past a bicycle. In Pennsylvania, it's illegal to do so, or vice versa. I can't remember which is which. But so there are a lot of these inconsistencies that, you know, how do you program for that?
Oh, and if you try to impose a requirement like that on the software at the state level, that could be complicated. If you're a national mm-hmm. manufacturer and you've got to make sure that your car changes its behavior every time it crosses a state line, that could be crazy. I mean,
absolutely.
How do you solve for that regulatory problem to make sure that you don't have a patchwork like that?
And that's exactly the question. We have that, you know, request for making sure that states aren't placing, you know, safety standards or performance standards on vehicles. But when it comes to some of these operating standards, I think we're still grappling with that question and what the best way is to fix that isn't, you know, treading on state authority, but is still providing that necessary, you know, national framework.
And then do the localities come in at all? I mean, they deal with traffic regulation, yep. parking tickets, the most granular level. Do they play a role in this discussion too?
They do, and certainly, you know, they play a big role in it right now on the testing side. I mean, you mentioned Pittsburgh. You know, you've got a couple different cities across the country that are really embracing this technology and trying to bring folks in to experiment there. One, it's great for business, but two, you know, that kind of data is so important to getting this technology off the ground. I mean, getting real road experience is essential. The only way that we're going to really figure out if this technology is safe is to put it in every type of situation, not just, you know, a testing facility with ideal conditions, but, you know, bad weather, bad lane markings, all of those things that, that a human driver can respond to, you know, most of the time, fairly well. Not always.
If they're sober.
Exactly. But, we have to make sure that the software is able to perform at that level as well. So that's incredibly important. And I think that localities are a lot of them are embracing that. I think you're seeing some that are more nervous and trying to, you know, set in place restrictions. I haven't seen any outright bans yet on this technology, and I don't expect to. I think that for the most part, people see and recognize the potential that this creates for their constituency.
Yeah, we have 30,000 vehicular deaths a year in this country. Correct me if I'm wrong on that. And given that you're someone who's super excited about this technology, I'm excited by this technology. I think it has the potential to make it more attractive to live further outside of a city. It could help alleviate congestion. It could make it cheaper to live. If you could afford to live in a neighborhood an hour away and you can sleep in the car on your way to work, that kind of stuff is all great. The potential's so great. It could get screwed up potentially by bad policy. So as someone who's super excited about this, as you are, what keeps you up at night, or what do you see as a potential barrier to innovation and this moving forward?
I think, you know, my fear is seeing something happen with one of these test vehicles, an accident or something, or a death, that causes a knee-jerk reaction to all of a sudden, you know, ban this technology.
Dare I say, techno panic?
Yeah, exactly. We're never mind the fact that humans are not great drivers. I mean,
was that 94% of accidents are caused by human error?
Exactly. But my concern there is, you know, when you suddenly take that responsibility from humans to technology, and you have just one, the reaction is totally different. And so, you know, we like to say, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. We can make vast improvements on roadway safety, but my fear is that something bad happens and it just puts a complete halt to development and deploying this really, you know, life-saving and life-changing technology.
Well, one thing that worries me, because of course that's the obvious techno panic, right? That a car is involved in an accident and we immediately blame the car, and that happened with the Tesla Autopilot. Yep. And we've seen this before with technology in general, but privacy is a big one, right? Because
yes,
right now it's just kind of connected cars. You have like a 4G connection in your car, and maybe there's like a multimedia interface and that has some internet component and they're collecting data, and people get a little creeped out by that. And we're talking about much broader data collection when we get to driverless cars. How important is data collection when we deal with driverless cars?
It's essential. And I'd like to try and break this down into different buckets for people. Data buckets is, you know, you have your data, that the vehicle data that is totally anonymized. It's performance measures and things like that, manufacturers rely on to make improvements to products. And that's, you know, across the tech.
Like how far did it drive before getting a flat tire, or how does it respond to the rain, things like that?
I think with connected vehicles, you'll get more of those type data points. Then you've got your probably more internal driving. So geolocation data is something that people get a little concerned about on the privacy side. So some of those more like personally identifiable data, and that's kind of a different bucket. There's testing data and things that that manufacturers and tech companies are pulling together now that is proprietary. And there are a lot of conversations about, everyone should share this data and share this data with the federal government to prevent accidents or make sure that we're getting the best product and avoiding the pitfalls. There are a lot of concerns on that aspect, sharing proprietary information, antitrust, concerns, but also, competitive advantages. If company X puts, $3 billion into testing a certain spot, and then the second company comes along and can just have that data and say, okay, well, we can just take that and, not spend that money. And it creates a competitive issue. So there's that concern. I think the biggest concern right now, though, is folks worrying about the privacy and, cybersecurity angle.
Yeah, of course.
How do we deal with that?
Before the show, I was, talking about how I was going to interview you about self-driving cars, and the guy I was talking to said, oh, just wait till those things get hacked. So I guess we've talked a little bit about privacy, and there's that concern about data collection. But of course, what's on everyone's mind is, my car is going to get hacked, or the government's going to have a kill switch where they can turn off my car. I mean, how have you been looking at the cybersecurity element of this debate?
Yeah, and that's a huge issue. I mean, you mentioned hacking, and we saw the in 2015, the Jeep hacking issue. So that is definitely top of mind for manufacturers, for innovators in this space, that this is something that we need to make sure that there are, you know, firewalls between the connectivity side and the, you know, infotainment side and actual operation of the vehicles. You know, there, I think it was last year, the auto industry came together and put together an auto ISAC, to information sharing center, to share information on threats, on cyber threats, which, you know, is meant to be helpful to. So if there is a vulnerability or there's a problem, it gets out to everybody quickly so that you can, you know, prevent that, as well as, you know, privacy principles and things that that the industry needs to be working on from a design standpoint to make sure that this is top of mind right from the beginning and right from the get-go.
Given that there's so much concern around privacy and cybersecurity, and my concern is that the techno panic around those two things will get in the way of saving lives, right? Because there's this balance, and we have to accept that there's going to be a screw up with privacy occasionally, where, you know, a manufacturer maybe collects too much or collects something they shouldn't have or doesn't properly anonymize the data. There might be screw ups with cybersecurity too. My concern is we've got 30,000 lives a year that we're talking about. So there has to be some type of trade-off between accepting a certain level of risk in the testing and the rollout of a new technology, which could be clumsy and messy. I mean, that's what dynamism is all about. And then this other ideal of preventing privacy and cybersecurity problems. So given that, and there's this these competing values, do you have recommendations, or does CTA have recommendations to policymakers to properly balance privacy and cybersecurity versus public safety?
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, that's definitely a key concern for us. And the, you know, the way we've been approaching this problem is it's so early in the process. We're just, you know, building this technology. It's not, you know, we talk about the vision for the future and what things are going to look like, but we don't, you know, 100% know yet. You know, this technology is still being developed. So my biggest concern is, you know, government rushing to regulate every potential hypothetical problem that could come along in a way that ends up just totally hamstringing, you know, innovation and tying the hands of companies that are trying to solve a lot of these problems and save lives. So we really, you know, push and recommend that we continue with a, you know, an industry-led coordination and effort, you know, along with NHTSA and with regulators, that allows for flexibility and dealing with these issues and answering these questions as we go along, right? I mean, you can't solve for everything that you could possibly think of, you know, before we even start actually building it.
Yeah, we've seen the cart before the horse problem, mm-hmm. where NHTSA put out quote unquote voluntary guidelines saying, states, we are specifically telling you not to do anything. And then California said, oh, cool, you want us to do something? And then they took the NHTSA guidelines and turned it into a statewide regulation. And groups like the Competitive Enterprise Institute, they came on my podcast to criticize that move because you basically just couldn't follow the instructions that the federal government gave you. So, you know, looking at all of the things we've talked about, you know, intellectual property concerns, competition, the benefit of information sharing for preventing hacks, but also concern about selling secrets to your competitors or whatever. Any final words on all the ground we've covered, which was a lot. And mm-hmm. I think we've got a pretty decent idea of where things are going and what the fault lines are, but anything you'd like to leave the listeners with before we wrap up?
Yeah, I think, you know, just look at the big picture, you know, look at the goals of where we're going. And, you know, we're continuing to try and work together and, you know, create a framework that is flexible and consistent and, you know, make sure that we're all able to realize this. I mean, looking at the, you know, potential of this technology and figuring out how we can make sure that we continue to be able to realize it is really important.
Well, we'll leave it there. My guest has been Jamie Boone, Senior Director of Government Affairs for the Consumer Technology Association, which represents many of the companies involved in this technology. So lots of coordination there. And thanks so much for joining the show.
Thank you.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Tech Freedom. Let us know what you think. Send us an email at media at techfreedom.org. Find this podcast in the iTunes store. Please write us a review because we'll help others find the show. Thanks for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.